think if we move on to sort of the Dharma post here, which is the focus of the book which you've written, then we sort of see that because, of course, the situation which develops around there is because whilst the Afghan forces have pulled back, they still pose a threat to the British forces in that area to begin with. We've got a general who's achieved not quite a stunning success, but he certainly makes great play of it later. And there's a sense that if he achieved another notable victory, you know, his position would be immeasurably enhanced. And there's a threat from the Afghan forces which is retained around the sort of Kurram Valley, isn't there?
Very much so. And indeed, up at Piwar Katal, beyond Parashinar, even after the ceasefire has officially been notified on the 3rd of June, the Afghans continue to attack, although that dies away fairly swiftly. And by the 6th and 7th of June, they have been pushed back to the Afghan side of the Durand line. So it does die out, and when General Fagan, the commander up in Parashinar, questions the Afghans, they say, you know, we have only just been notified and we have pulled back. But there remains up and down the Kurram Valley tension on the border itself, all the way through June and July, and throughout the region, the tribes remain in a state of unrest. They never openly rise, perhaps in the way the Afghans had originally hoped, but they are certainly causing, only too happy to cause trouble in whatever way they can. And halfway up the Kurram Valley is a post called Sada, which is where a tributary to the Kurram flows from the east into the Kurram Valley. So the Kurramana joins the River Kurram at that point. And about 2 or 3 miles to the northeast of Sada is the little post of Badama Post, which guards the entrance to the Kurramana Valley, effectively. So Parashinar and Thal are linked by a track/road, which passes through Sada at that point there. And the Kurramana runs to the northeast up into what's known as Orakzai's territory and Zamkut's are the two principal tribes up in that region.
Okay, so we've got a strategically valuable post because it provides sort of lookout onto the routes of advance for a potential grand force and for tribal forces to be moving as well. But there are other key heights in this area as well, which the Kurram militia have recaptured, and they sort of form a stepping stone.
Very much so. The Kurram militia operated throughout the Kurram Valley effectively they had 15 or 20 posts. And a post is really a small fort, not very big, but perhaps 10 metres on each side. It's not a huge establishment. It could hold perhaps, depending on the size, anywhere between 20 people up to perhaps 100 for one of the biggest ones. They are literally forts in the way that we would know it. Quite often they even have raised doorways. You couldn't get a horse inside or there would be a central keep and then surrounded by walls in which you'd put horses. You certainly couldn't get any wheeled vehicle like a truck in. And they effectively formed garrison points all up and down the Kurram Valley from Thal up to Parashinar and then all right up onto the Durand line at Piwar and Kalachi were the two sort of principal points to the north and west of Parashinar where you could cross onto the border.
Okay, so we've got, during the ceasefire, a situation where there's not sort of outright hostilities, but there are sort of little actions happening, and there's a continuing threat. We've got this series of outposts, and within that, there's a need to supply them. And so I think that's a nice point for which to explain what this aircraft, which you know your book structured around, was doing when it ended up being shot down.
Right, we need to jump our way forward then to 29th and 30th of July, so very end of July, when, as we were saying, the tension has died down and the regular troops are being pulled back and operations effectively for the Kurram militia are returning to normal. There are still some additional forces in Parashinar, certainly. One of them was 22nd Battery Motor Machine Gun Corps. Another was 3rd Battalion's of the Guides, Regiment, and the 57th Frontier Force Wilds Rifles Regiment was still Parachinar based at that time. But by this stage, 20 Squadron, in the middle of July, they started establishing a forward operating base at Parachinar. By the middle of July, their initial bid was to get a flight of four aircraft up there. So by the end of July, they certainly, we think, had four aircraft established in Parachinar. But it was a long, slow process getting them up there, because clearly the aircraft could fly, but there were associated ground crew. There was petrol. There were all the ancillaries of bombs, machine guns, bullets, etc.
I think they estimated to make a long distance move would require the equivalent of 67 Ford lorry loads. Obviously, a Ford lorry load would not be a Ford Transit at this point, but you know it's still a significant amount of transport which is needed to, you know, going backwards and forwards or in one go to move a squadron forward. And then, of course, there's a supply difficulty as well.
So, you know, this was coming forward by convoy on the road. A limited amount could be flown forward, but it was very limited. And then, of course, there was all the ground troops, food and petrol for motorbikes and food for British troops, etc., ammunition and the rest of it, all the logistics of war. And as we've said, convoys, slow-moving, bad roads, difficult terrain, tribesmen only too willing to give it a go. So a convoy would be escorted, normally a section or two of British infantry, perhaps in a lorry. At this stage, the British were starting to introduce armoured cars. Most of them were still pretty rudimentary, although they had shipped a couple back from Mesopotamia. And certainly at the end of July, there was a convoy moving from Thal up to Parachinar. It had an escort. As far as we know, it had no armoured cars in the escort, but we assume it had at least some infantry, probably no more than a section, perhaps two. But that could derive useful protection from having an aircraft. So that was one of the tasks that aircraft from 20 Squadron were given, was to fly protection for that convoy as it moved north.
Of course, the aircraft 20 Squadron are operating at this time is the Bristol Fighter, and it's the F2B, which is significant because it's the Falcon 3 engine, which is, I think, an output of something like 295 horsepower. And I promised Paul at the beginning I wouldn't get too technical on the F2B, and listeners who are technically minded will be agreeing with me at this point, even if I think he is not. The reason it's important, however, is because that's about three times more than the engine the BE-2C had in terms of horsepower. And it meant that not only was it able to take off at different times, you know, later into the day, it had a greater range. It was just a better aircraft in terms of what it could do. And the amount of reconnaissance time it could provide over this convoy was, again, in the region of about of a third greater than the BE-2C. And over mountainous terrain, again, that engine power really came into play because it meant that with the sort of prevailing atmospheric conditions which naturally occur in mountain ranges, it was able to cope with them a great deal better. So it's interesting to see this is the arrival of one of the mainstays of what becomes the RAF's Imperial Policing Force in this region.
The other point that is probably worth making at this point is 20 Squadron had a long history of operations on the Western Front at this point. And a number of the pilots and air crew had not demobilised at the end of the war. They had stayed with the squadron, and they had deployed to India, principally amongst them, perhaps the squadron commander, Percy Lale, highly decorated, and you know, hadn't been the squadron commander, and in fact still wasn't officially the squadron commander at that stage, but his squadron commander had been taken to go and command the wing, therefore Percy was the squadron commander at that stage. Another one is Edmund Britton, known as Babs Britton, shot down just before the end of the war in France. He escaped by disguising himself as a woman. He was of slightly small stature, but he successfully made his way back to British lines, having been shot down, I think, in either late October or early November of 18. Whether they were at Parachinar, I don't know. point I was going to make was that 20 Squadron were, you know, arguably the most successful British squadron of the First World War. Particularly in the 1918 German March attack, they had established a very sound reputation for ground support. So they were, whilst they were principally an offensive counter-air squadron, they had done lots of work supporting the army. And they brought that knowledge to India with them, whilst 31 Squadron, not to decry the work that they had done, but they had been operating in a different theatre.
No, I think it's a really good point that you bring up, because, of course, 20 Squadron had been operating these aircraft, and the ground attack roles, which it's got experience of and has developed tactics for during, you know, the First World War on the Western Front, that experience definitely comes into play, again, having to support troops in this role. So, we've got a convoy going back to Badama, having, you know, enjoyed our excursion into 20 Squadron. So we're going back to Badama, and it's actually quite difficult, based on the records now, to know exactly what 20 Squadron's role with this convoy was. Whether or not it was to provide an escort for it, in a sense, whether it was just providing reconnaissance, or if it was there to bomb and attack tribal forces in the area. So, I mean, I think it's a sort of nice time to discuss your sort of research more generally, sort of how you went about establishing what the aircraft, what the mark of the aircraft was, or the serial number of the aircraft, who was involved, the general details of its operations, because it's quite an interesting, singular instance of air support, which helps explore the rest of the Third Afghan War and elsewhere.
Yes, when I first started studying the incident, my immediate assumption was there's only one squadron involved in Afghanistan in the Third Afghan War. So I looked at 31 Squadron's records, and there is nothing which affects the date of the operation. Because my grandfather left an account with a date, I know when this incident occurred to a reasonable degree of accuracy. The picture I've built up of the whole incident is drawn from a number of sources. For the ground units, particularly the war diaries, and there is a war diary of 22nd Battery Motor Machine Gun Service. For the Kurram Militia have their war diary, which covers the incident as well. And Headquarters 60 Infantry Brigade, who were the force located in Parachinar, also have a war diary. So there are a number of ground sources which give a feel for what the troops on the ground were doing. I eventually found it was 20 Squadron simply by going back to the Middle East operational reports, because the aircraft in India were operating to 52nd Wing, which was also then reported back to the Middle East headquarters. So there was a weekly operational summary sent back to headquarters RAF in the Middle East, which picked up Mesopotamia as well as the events on the Afghan frontier. And eventually by trawling through them, I came through a report that stated that 20 Squadron on the 30th of July 1919 had two aircrew wounded and had lost an aircraft. You've mentioned that 31 Squadron lost aircraft in the Khyber. Throughout, I had reasoned that, you know, aircraft were extremely valuable assets, and indeed the British went to considerable efforts to recover not just the aircrew if they lost an aircraft, but as much of the airframe as they could as well. It was highly valued. So I reasoned that there must be a record of losing an aircraft if an aircraft had been shot down. Once I had that 20 Squadron record, had the name of the squadron, I was then able to shift focus from 31 Squadron to 20 Squadron. An operational history of 20 Squadron from formation in 1915 on the Western, or rather in UK, shipping out to the Western Front and then subsequently shipping to India. And it covers up to the end of the 1930s, although there is sadly a significant gap in the middle of the 1920s, which excludes Pink's War from this particular record. But this record records that on the 29th of July, the squadron suffered its first casualties in India during operations around Badama post in bombing operations. And it gives the serial of the aircraft, so it's Bristol Fighter 4626. The casualties, Captain G. Eastwood, and Second Lieutenant DM Lepreik. So that gave me two names on which we could work. The RAF Museum here has its story vault collections. That includes casualty cards. And by taking both Eastwood as the pilot and Lepreik as the observer gunner, gained their casualty cards for the incident, and given us the 30th of July, again, their casualty cards are in the museum story vault. So with a bit of tracking down, it was nice to get there.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a great story for you personally, because, of course, your grandfather is involved in the rescue.
Yes, he didn't pull them out of the aircraft. We've discussed the aircraft we think was on convoy escort duties. The various accounts suggest that because there was a tribal gathering in the Kumana at the time, possibly with the purpose of attacking the convoy, suggests that the aircraft were certainly sent to recce and overfly, possibly to bomb as well. The joy of the Bristol fighter was it was well armed with both machine guns and could carry bombs into the bargain. So my deduction is that they were probably, Eastwood and Lepreik were probably tasked to escort the convoy for as long as they had fuel or sufficient duration. And then to deviate on their return to their landing strip at Parachinar, to deviate up the Kumana and to see if they could spot the tribal gathering that might be threatening Badama and indeed Sada posts.
Well, we certainly know that there were tribesmen in the area, yeah, because this aircraft is brought down by rifle fire.
There are various reports of snipers or gatherings of tribesmen. Suffice it to say, the aircraft was brought down. You spoke of the very complimentary reports of the RAF at the siege of Thal. There are other accounts which, whilst they're still complimentary, they do emphasise some of the difficulties RAF had with reconnaissance in particular. The tribesmen became very adept at blending into the terrain. Their robes were dusty coloured. The terrain was pretty difficult. It was relatively easy for them just to lie still and let the aircraft pass overhead. And travelling at 100 plus miles an hour, particularly at low level, it's quite difficult to pick that out. I think the aircraft came down because they actually hit the most important component of all, or the most vital component of all, the pilot. George Eastwood's casualty card tells us he was hit in the chest by a rifle bullet, but the aircraft came down. The Kurram Militia's diary and the official histories very much claim that the Kurram Militia did all the stripping of the aircraft, helping the aircrew and all the rest of it. Indeed, the official history claims that the pilot and aircrew roughly dismantled the aircraft themselves. I find that a little tricky. When the pilot had been shot in the chest, the observer had severe lacerations to his face and possibly concussion.
Did he not lose three teeth as well?
He lost three teeth.
Yeah. So give an idea of the force of a crash on the observer, you know, not only did he have his face pretty badly cut up, he also lost three teeth. I suspect he was rather lucky not to have his jaw broken.
And I'm full of admiration for George Eastwood's skill or luck in managing to get the aircraft down sufficiently in one piece that he and his observer climbed out of it.
I'm full of admiration, not only did they climb out, they then roughly dismantled this aircraft.
I think they were helped into the post, into Badama post, by the Kurram Militia. I don't think they made any effort to dismantle the aircraft.
Understandably. One had a large hole in his chest, probably, and the other is bleeding profusely from his jaw.
Yes, I think they probably scrambled out of the ravine in which, or Lepreik helped Eastwood out of the ravine. They were then picked up by a patrol of the Kurram Militia, which would have seen the aircraft come down, and helped into the post from there. At this stage, the OC of the Kurram Militia had linked up with my grandfather and his section of motor machine guns. A section effectively was six motorcycle combinations, i.e. motorcycle and sidecar, of which two of those would be gun carriers, so carrying a Vickers machine gun. The other four were ammunition and spares carriers and carried the rest of the crew for each of the guns. So a gun crew was six blokes. Two guns, two crews, six combinations. A solo Triumph motorcycle for my grandfather as the section commander. A job normally done by a young officer, but at that stage, the only officers in the battery at that stage were the battery commander, a chap called Major Alexander Molony, and his second in commander, a captain, Max Roscher. But neither of them were present at the Dharma post. They were both, I think, back at Parachinar. According to my grandfather, they had been overflown by Brisfit 4626 and Eastwood and Le Prake. They hadn't seen the aircraft return, so they had assumed something had happened to it. So they'd moved up to the Dharma post themselves, and here they'd met the militiamen bringing the aircrew back to the post. At that stage, they then gave first aid to the two aircrew. My grandfather, Sergeant McCrow, had one of his Ford trucks with him. They cleared that truck of any equipment, and the aircrew were then evacuated on that truck back to Kohat, and both subsequently survived. Because my grandfather had been RAF trained, he and Major Dodd climbed down to the aircraft. Grandfather climbed into the cockpit, dropped the bombs, made sure they were safe to handle. And I'm guessing he didn't have the wire clips that would have disarmed them, but
sort of hoping he made sure they were safe to handle before dropping them personally. But yeah, sorry, worried when you said that.
his account isn't quite that detailed as to exactly what he did, but he would have toggled them off. Of course, they're safe enough on the bomb rack, because it's only when they are dropped off the bomb rack that the vane can then spin. Which eventually, after I think it's 25 rotations for a Cooper bomb, will arm the bomb. But of course, you need the clip or the wire to put into to stop the vane spinning, which is the normal procedure for once you've removed it from the rack, you then disarm it or stop the vane spinning so that it cannot become armed thereafter. The vane can't spin while it's held on the rack. I suspect the militiamen who carried them back up to the post had some fairly dire warnings ringing in their ears, although given they were under sniper fire at the time.
Yes, this is all under fire, hostile tribesmen, and I think we've talked about the loss of the aircraft and how it might have happened. There's quite a few instances of where, you know, tribesmen who are excellent shots had led the aircraft ahead, used their rifle, led it, and pulled off a good shot, hit the engine and brought it down. I think you're probably right, given the fact we know that Eastwood was hit in the chest, that it's most likely they hit the pilot in this instance. But I'd imagine there's probably, you know, a few of them sniping at the aircraft. Again, you know, as you said, they're able to hide very well in the terrain. The sound of the aircraft approaching is a bit of a giveaway. Nothing else quite like that in Afghanistan at this time. So one of those instances where the use of aircraft, but also its limitations, is really revealed during this operation. Because, yes, it's able to provide reconnaissance for this convoy, and the convoy isn't attacked. But on the other hand, to spot anybody, any hostile tribesmen at this time, once they've got used to aircraft and can hide, you have to come down to quite low levels, and then you're at danger from enemy fire. And also, because of the hills either side, there are times when the tribesmen are literally able to fire down onto the aircraft, which is a slightly counterintuitive way of thinking about ground fire on aircraft, but it does happen on several occasions during these operations. But if we just, I think, round off the end of the Dharma action, your grandfather is mentioned in dispatches for it, isn't he?
Yes, that's correct. Percy Dodd got a distinguished service order. My grandfather's account ends with a very traditional soldier's whinge, turns around and says he went back to his officer commanding, Major Molyneux, and reported what he had done or the success of his mission to go to the Dharma post. He recounts that Major Molyneux had already received good reports of his conduct from Major Dodd. A mention was made of a Distinguished Conduct Medal. However, nothing more was ever heard of this. But it's very nice to have as a piece of family story. My grandfather's medals, his mention in dispatches, oak leaves, along with his telegram of notification of mention in dispatches. It's signed in 1920, and of course the Secretary of State for War who signed the telegram at that stage was Winston Churchill.
I think he's not the only one to get shortchanged in terms of medals, in terms of the Third Afghan War. The peace treaty itself is not welcomed back in London, partly because of the way it's been handled, partly because having gone to the expense of fighting the war, we then end up sort of sacrificing control of Afghan foreign policy. The thought in India is that it would be easier to have the same amount of influence by developing soft power mechanisms over the Afghans in the long term. So we sort of, in one respect, reach the end of the Afghan war from here. But going backwards and looking at air operations, in terms of other areas, we've got the Khyber is still having minor hostilities, the Afridis who are fighting in that area. one of their strongholds is attacked, and the RAF play some role again in escorting troops marching up, in artillery spotting and reconnaissance, so continuing operations there for them. But also in the Zob, there's a limited amount of RAF presence. In fact, it's non-existent at first. And then as hostilities increase there, hostile tribesmen rather than regular Afghanistan forces, there's a need for aircraft to operate in support of Fort Sandaman, which has now been besieged, having had a previous convoy bringing supplies to it been ambushed and badly cut up, all the supplies seized. And much like Fall, where a relief column is sent out, an aircraft sort of support it and let the garrison know what's happening. Similar things happen at Fort Sandaman. In fact, in one instance, the garrison is able to resupplement its water supply with aircraft providing cover to stop tribal forces attacking the troops having left the fort. So it's quite an interesting example of how the RAF's, one of its key roles is providing cover over ground forces and preventing tribesmen attacking them or surprising them. And that's one of the things we see when we go into Waziristan as well for the sort of uprisings there, the local tactical support, which is sometimes decried because there's not enough RAF presence during the Third Afghan War, but with the arrival of more squadrons in the region. And if we look at Waziristan, there is more support for the ground forces there.
Yes, I mean, Waziristan was as we've said, it was the focus of the most virulent and dangerous tribes, the Mashuds and the Wazirs. Ground operations were very restricted there, and it was after the armistice was signed in August 19, the tribes were still kicking off in Waziristan very much. They were probably fermented from over the border a bit as well, even though, and the British still needed to re-establish control over Waziristan. I mean, the Waziristan militia had mutinied and dissolved. They had lost control of the tribe. The British had lost control of the tribes. And from a ground perspective, that was very much done by building roads. Eventually, roads were built into the major towns of the interior. I suppose there are modern parallels with building a road from Lashkargah up to Sangin in Helmand Province. The British built roads into Derat and to Tank, and then pushed British control to a large extent using armoured cars on the ground. That was where the armoured castle came into its own, having been shipped back from Mesopotamia. But at the end of 1919 and going into 1920, and then subsequently, because the trouble continued, but it was the road building and the establishment of British control. And it was very much ground and air operations, ground operations supported by air at this stage. Particularly important, I think, from a ground troops role, was you've touched on the quality of the ground troops. They, at the start of the Waziristan campaign in September, October 1919, they were not even quite often the quality of the troops that had been involved in the Third Afghan War. There was a lot of learning to do, and they relied heavily on air support from the RAF. It was very important.
Yeah, I mean, there's a moment in Waziristan where things could have gone quite badly wrong. Fortunately, that situation's turned around, but it reaches the point where the army's unwilling isn't quite the right term, because it's just they couldn't have done. But there's a realisation that the advance is best done when covered by air, and it is accepted that when it can't because of weather conditions, then the advance won't be made that day. And that's a really important moment in terms of army-air cooperation. Tactics which develop around that go into the interwar period. Basil Embury, who serves in the Second World War, talks about how pickets are eventually covered throughout the day with sort of rotating reconnaissance. It's a really interesting sort of learning curve within this part of the Northwest Frontier alone. One of those sort of fascinating areas, and sort of an area where I think we're probably going to want to do something later. But it's a nice point to sort of stop this podcast to see the Third Afghan War reading into the Northwest Frontier, where we see in the Third Afghan War, long-range bombing and reconnaissance having the most effect, but because of the limitations of the aircraft and the numbers available, not much tactical support. And then we go into the Waziristan campaign, where more aircraft are available, they're better, and there aren't as many targets to bomb. And we see that in Pink's War as well, where whilst there is a bombing campaign which is done by the RAF, it's often the disruption in everyday life which really has an effect.
Yeah, I think that's very true for Pink's War, certainly. And 20 Squadron, of course, were still involved, although sadly we know less of the details because of the missing record at the moment.
Okay, well, that's amazing. I think before we end, Paul, do you want to tell people about your book?
Well, that's kind, thanks. Yes, it's called Action at Badama Post. It's published by Casemate UK, and it is available from them from the end of July 2019, or through other websites.
Okay.